Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode number 162 of the Apologue Podcast. I am your host, Simon Head. Welcome to the show. This episode is brought to you in part by Bose All Natural Brewing. Check out their Lug Tread beer. It's crisp, balanced, and refreshing. Lug Tread is a lagered ale. It's a term they coined. It's fermented like an ale and cold-aged like a lager. It's been Bo's flagship brand since they opened in 2006. And as of 2017, almost 2018, it's now available in 355-milliliter cans for the first time and has won more than 20 awards. Check out the Kissmeyer Nordic Pale Ale. It is really good. That's my favorite one. The Tom Green Cherry Milk Stout. Tom Green's a Canadian comedian. I don't know if anybody knows that, but he's a very funny guy. Eminem mentions him in one of his songs, The Slim Shady. Tom Green humped a dead moose in, well, it's not a proud moment in Canada. But regardless, check out the Cherry Milk Stout. Check out Wag the Wolf. It's part of their Wild Oats series. Their full-time IPA, it's hoppy, fruity, and bold. It's their newest full-time brand, which is how they got the name for it. It's medium-bodied, finishes dry with lingering hop and fruit notes. And for all you beer nerds, that's good. So pick up Bose anywhere. Beer is sold nationwide. Go to www.bose.ca for more info on their great products. And do that. Sorry, Americans, you can't do that. But you could. Maybe you could. If you're in Canada, check out the Bose. It's delish. It tastes like European beer, actually. I think their brewmeister is from Germany. Hey, Amazon shoppers. Do you want to support the show? Do you want to shop on Amazon? Christmas is coming. Check out apologue.ca/Amazon or apologue.ca/US Amazon. Shop and support the show. Bookmark the links while you're at it. And if you want to do it the old-fashioned way, go to apologue.ca and click on the banners located on the right side. Look at your country, Canada, America, or UK. Bookmark those links, and every time you shop on Amazon, same thing. You're supporting the show, and it costs you no extra money. If you want to support the show on a monthly basis, go to patreon.com/apologue. Pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with hosting and gas fees. Go to apologue.ca to buy a t-shirt. Check out all the news by going to facebook.com/apologuepod. Follow me on Twitter at SimonHead666. And last but not least, don't forget about iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show, and give it 5 stars, please. It's very important how the show is ranked in the scheme of things. And the podcast is doing quite well, but it could do better. Everything could do better. Today on the show, I have Brandon Kellum, who plays in a band called American Standards. And they're a hardcore band. I don't say hardcore band. They have just put out a new record, and we're going to listen to some music halfway through it. But everybody, here he is, Brandon Kellum from the American Standards on the Apple App Podcast. It's nice to meet you.
You too. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm excited. I'm a fan of the podcast. I think you've had some really cool guests on.
Oh, cool.
So the fact that you responded to me, I was thrilled.
It's the power of podcasts, man. Like, I think it's funny how people can discover new things, and it's you can do it on your own now. I mean, I don't know how old you are, but it used to be a time where, you know, you'd have the record business and or the industry would kind of tell you what to like, and now everybody can sort of branch out on their own and like everything.
I definitely remember going to the record store and getting the little sampler CDs and having 20 bands on there and being really excited about the one or two to tell your friends about.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, thanks for, yeah. I mean, I'm always looking for cool people to talk to. I'm always like excited about music. And I was thinking about it today. I'm like, how many people play music and they all kind of do it for the same purpose, and they kind of play music because they love it. And it's not like in punk rock and stuff like that, people are just want to make good music. I mean, it's obviously not driven by a dollar bill.
Yeah, especially now. I mean, if you're playing punk rock for money, you're doing the wrong thing.
Or your bad religion.
Yeah, I guess so, right?
So,
yeah, no, I think when we started, we definitely knew there wasn't any money in it. It was really just about getting out there and having a good time. And I think we use it as a means, like a vessel to really have experiences, right? I mean, so many people in my life, if not I would say 99% of the people that I know in my life are all directly through music, you know, whether it be the guys in a band, their friends, the people we meet at shows, or people like you that we talk to. They become like lifelong people in your, that you, you know, interact with.
Yeah. The music network is very strong. I don't know any other type of network, but I'm pretty sure it sort of across the board. There's like, you meet good people, you talk to them, you like them, you hang out with them, and then you play with them, especially when you're in bands, because you get to sort of like run into them from time to time. And you guys, it sounds like you guys do a little bit of traveling around and things like that, right?
Yep. Yeah. We try to go around quite a bit, actually. Now that we've been doing it for about 6 years, it's almost a necessity that we play out of our home state more often than we play in our home state.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereabouts in Arizona are you?
We're in Phoenix. Right in the capital. Yep.
Cool. Yeah. I haven't been down there in a very long time. I used to manage bands, and we used to go through there quite a bit. And I love Arizona. Like you say, it's hot. Yeah. But the winters, what are the winters like down there?
I mean, it gets down to about 70 is kind of, and the nights it gets a bit cooler, but the days are about 75, 80 degrees. It's nice out. It's one of those things where you can wear shorts if you wanted to, or you can wear jeans and a jacket.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So where do you guys travel out to? Do you make it as far west as LA? Like, what's your boundaries?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've pretty much done the full United States, with the exception of, you know, Alaska and Hawaii, multiple times. We do hit the West Coast quite a bit, and we love it out there. We have a lot of friends and bands out there. But much like Phoenix, people don't always think of Phoenix as a music hub, but it really has the same benefits and challenges that big places like New York or Los Angeles have, where there's a ton of bands, a ton of musicians, no lack of shows. But the fact that there's so much going on, I mean, any given night, you've got 5 or 10 punk rock shows or metal shows. So it makes it easy to start a band and easy to play shows, or as a fan to go to shows, but also harder to cut through all the noise.
Yeah. 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 Phoenix is, it's still considered a pretty sizable city, but, for arts and culture and things like that, it must still be pretty strong. Cause that's the part when you travel through, you sort of stop, you play the club, and then you leave, and you don't really get a chance to sort of look around, so to speak.
Explore a bit. Yeah. No, I think it's great to see how everybody's perspective is that's never actually been touring or like kind of lived that life. Because you see, especially now with online, you see a guy in a band, you see his Instagram feed or his Facebook, and you see all these great pictures of all this stuff. But that picture is probably the one thing that happened after an 8-hour drive of just seeing, you know, out the window. Pretty much touring in a band, you get to see gas stations and eat all the great food that comes with, you know, QT or Circle K.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I messed up when I was tour managing. We were coming from LA, and we came to Phoenix, and the hour changed, and I completely dropped the ball as to what time we were supposed to be there. Because if you drive, you can drive kind of straight from LA if you wanted to, but I completely screwed it up. And we show up you guys are about an hour late for your show. I'm like, oh, fuck. Sorry, man. Yeah.
And Phoenix isn't easy with that either. We're the only, I think the only place in the States that doesn't observe daylight savings time. So when everybody else is changing, we just say, nope, we're keeping to what we are.
Yeah.
So it makes it more difficult.
Yeah. It's fairly flat, right? Phoenix, or is it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a valley. It's all flat. I mean, we're surrounded by mountains. So any direction you look, there's mountains. But Phoenix is all flat.
Yeah. So your band, you've been a band for 6 years,
American Standards. Yep, 6 years. We actually, Cody, our original guitarist, he reached out to me on New Year's Eve of 2010, and we kind of started going from there.
Yeah. And so y'all obviously played in other bands and things like that. Like, is that sort of how
you met? Those bands, exactly. All those bands that we used to be in kind of fell apart around the same time. Mm-hmm. And we were all like in our young to mid 20s at the time. I was actually 26 at the time when we started the band. And I think we were kind of all iffy if we wanted to jump back into bands, because we had all been touring in bands for, you know, 5 or 10 years. And at first we just said, hey, we're going to get together. We're going to jam. We're just going to do it for fun. And it's kind of like that whole thing, like when you say, I'm not looking for a relationship, and then all of a sudden everybody seems interested. It was the exact same thing. It's like, all right, now we're not even going to try with the band to do anything big. And then all of a sudden we're getting the biggest show offers and tour offers we've ever got. We're getting label interest and everything else. And it's really when we stopped trying to get that is when it started coming.
Yeah. And you guys are, it sounds like you were a little bit older than most bands start their sort of bit, their bands in their early 20s, and they kind of, it's funny how they break up. And if you think about like the actual, the mind of an adult isn't fully developed until you're like 27, you know what I mean? So, and that's when you can put things into priority and make a good assessment, and you have enough experience behind you to make good decisions. And good decisions, they roll, it's like a snowball, you know? And you know, I get that part.
Yeah, but if you start a band and you're 17 or 18, you have no clue where you're going to be at 25. And that's why most bands end up going through all that stress, because now they're 25 and, you know, they've got a girlfriend or a wife or kids, or they've got a mortgage to worry about. And they start thinking, all right, I've got different priorities than I had 10 years ago. And that's why you see all these bands have had so many lineup changes.
Yeah, and you can look at things like an adult and make better decisions, because when you're 20 and you're 17, you're like, you're still a child.
Yeah. It's easy to rush into the first label that's interested in you, or the first tour offer that you get, even though you're going to be, you know, paying out of pocket and eating ramen for every meal.
Someone told me you can live off ramen for a year, and it's something like $190 or something for like the whole year.
I feel like that'd be a reality show. It's like the guy that eats fast food every day.
Yeah, it's true. So do you have children? Are you in still that area in life, or are you?
No. So actually, I've been with my girlfriend for 9 years now. We just had our 9-year anniversary. Wow. And we do take care of two kids, her aunt's kids. Her aunt passed away, so we take care of them. But yeah, no kids of our own, really. So
yeah.
So well, still fairly in that regard. I mean, obviously, I've got my home life, but then we go out on the road too, and we try to balance the two.
Yeah. So you've just put a new record out, right? I got it here.
We did. Yep.
Yeah, and that's what. How many records now? How many is that?
This would be the fourth release, but a couple of those were EPs. So yeah. we kind of started off with a full length, and then we went to 5 songs, and then we went down to 3 songs. So we progressively released less and less content as we went. Just I think based on the way, you know, music has changed and it's become more of, you've got to release more frequently, and people are just listening to singles on Spotify. So we released less and less, but we did want, with the last album, we kind of had a bigger gap between it, and we wanted to put out something more. So Anti-Melody came out about 6 months ago, and it's a full length in the sense that punk rock album could be full length. I think it's still about 30 minutes, 35 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. That, you know, that's enough. I mean, and the other thing, the whole thing about keeping something short is that people are going to want to listen to it again. Like, you don't want to wear it, you're welcome, you know, musically.
Yep. I'm all for the mindset. When you're playing a show, you know, play your best 25, 35 minutes of music. No need to extend to solos or to, you know, do these big old breaks between the set.
Yeah. So your shows are pretty intense, right? You there?
Yeah, we're built on our shows. You know, I think if we can get to every single person in a live show setting, we can win them over, because that's really where we thrive.
So a record. So do you produce your own records and things? What's your process?
Yeah, we've got. Yeah, good question. So we've done a couple in the studios where. So the first two albums we did actually at a studio here in Arizona called JM Studios, and they've done some bigger bands from Arizona, bands like Greeley Estates and I Set to Kill and things like that. For this last one, we actually went out to King Size Sound Labs, which is in Los Angeles. They've done like Bad Religion and Mars Volta, Andrew WK. So they've done some bigger bands. But unfortunately, during that process, we lost our founding guitarist, Cody, to suicide. Ooh. And then also my father passed away to cancer very quickly. He was diagnosed, and from diagnosis to passing, it was, you know, just a few weeks. So we kind of had this thing where we had to start coming back from California to Phoenix, and we keep going back and forth for a while. We ended up tracking everything at the studio, taking it back home, and self-mixing and self-producing.
Man,
and that's the first time we've ever done that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry to hear about that. You know, it's amazing how many people you meet are victim to being left behind from people committing suicide. I mean, my brother killed himself 10 years ago, and you never actually ever heal. It always just keeps coming back from time to time. And, you know, he's your bandmate, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Depression is such a funky thing, man. People have it and they just don't, and they're good hide. People hide it. That's the creepy thing. That's the scary part, how that works out.
Yeah. It's like, I think people have this misconception of someone that's depressed or has extreme anxiety is going to be someone that doesn't have a lot of friends or isn't really social. But that's completely the opposite case, especially with Cody. I mean, everybody that he met loved him. He was always surrounded by people. He was always in high spirits. But at the same time, he had really high highs, and that's when he'd be around people. And he also had really low lows, and he'd kind of retract himself, and people just didn't see that other side.
Yeah, when you hang out by yourself, too. Yeah, that's the part. Yeah, when people are, extroverts, there's definitely a fear of being alone, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't get into that mindset. It's too weird because, I think everybody has that little bit inside. They have depression. Everybody's depressed about something. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You wouldn't be human if you weren't, you have to have, there's a balance of good and bad news that always comes at you, and whether or not you're going to, grasp it and cope with it or not cope with it. I mean, that's the question, but that's tough shit. That's really tough stuff, man. Like, so especially when it does, and your band is something that, it's supposed to be something, as music, it's supposed to be something you can sort of like separate from and sort of ignore life things, I guess, in a way. Right.
Yeah, you're right. And just like you said, I think it's almost like a spectrum in the sense that like everybody does have those highs and lows, and the lows almost make the highs better. But it's how you cope with it. And I think everybody kind of copes with it a little different. And especially with someone like Cody, he always kind of really was very reactive, on the moment. If he felt a certain way, you'd know exactly how he felt. So I think, it's just weird how that works.
Yeah, it's usually that's the, like when you tour in a van with people and someone pisses you off, it's like, you're pissing me off and I don't like you right now, but I will in 5 minutes from now because we're in the same van. We got to live with each other for like that period of time, right? That's a van life. So when you guys tour around, do you do extended trips or do you just sort of do weekends out and come back? Like what's your...
We do a few weeks at a time. So we try to every other month or every few months, we'll do about 3 weeks at a time. That's kind of the sweet spot for us where we feel like it's all fresh. It's all new. It doesn't feel like a job. Then anything after about 3 weeks, you start getting into that routine, which I hear a lot of guys and bands like the routine. Mm-hmm. But personally, like in life in general, not only the band, I hate getting into that routine. I love just feeling like everything's fresh and new. So we'll go out there for a few weeks and we'll do, Weekend Warrior stuff too. Yeah. But then we come back, we recharge, we'll play a local show, we'll, work on writing. And then we'll go back out there and it'll be just as fresh a month later.
Yeah. Yeah. Bands that travel for more than a month at a time, there's that hump you go over. There's the week of, woo, this is awesome. And then there's the second week of, here we go. And then there's the third and fourth week of, I can't wait to get home. I used to do lots of trips.
It reminds me of actually,
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, it reminds me, I was just out in Vegas and for a buddy's bachelor party. And we booked four nights in Vegas. And it's that same arc in a sense, just much quicker. Yeah. The first night's like, oh, we're in Vegas. The second night is like, oh, this is still pretty cool. The third night's like, why are we in Vegas? And the fourth night, we're all begging to go home.
My wife and I got married in the early 2000s. And all our friends pitched together and bought us a ticket to Vegas so we could go to Vegas, honeymoon in Vegas. And we were there for 3 days. And the third day, we went to the Grand Canyon. So we're like, yeah, we're here for two. We're going to go to the Grand Canyon, and it's a 10-hour drive. Like, it's a drive from Vegas, like Hoover Dam before the Big Bridge and stuff. And, that was enough for us. Like, 2 days in Vegas, you get super stuffed on food, and, that's a weird town,
man. Yep, that's
man.
The sweet spot.
Yeah.
You can tell the people on the strip that are there on day one and the people that are there on day three. They have a completely different facial expression.
Yeah. Do you gamble? Are you a gambler, or is that just something...
We do gamble a bit. I didn't used to gamble, and we didn't used to go to shows often. We just kind of go out there and party. And now I really enjoy the shows. We went and saw Penn and Teller. We got to meet them and hang out a bit.
Oh, cool.
Which was really cool. We gambled and we won quite a bit of money the first night. We actually went to this fancy steakhouse and got these like $100 steaks, which I would never spend that on my own dime, but it's the house's money. And then by day three, that dreaded day three, we're talking about, we lost quite a bit of the money that we won. and they were like, I can't believe you bought $100 steaks.
Yeah. Because, of course, like Phoenix and Vegas, how far do you drive there or do you fly?
We drove. It was about 5 hours.
Yeah.
It's not bad.
It's not bad,
four and a half,
right?
5 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fun road trip, especially when you got your friends in the car and everything, or if you're traveling. We go to Vegas pretty often to play with a band. So
yeah, it's pretty much the same time for Toronto for us to drive to Montreal or something, because Montreal's the funky town for Torontonians because it's French speaking mostly. So it feels like you're in another country for a little bit. But Vegas is its own country. Cool. Vegas is a freak town.
This is very true, you know, and you have probably just as many cultures and people from different walks of life in Vegas too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was talking, it's funny how that place turned into, it's a place to go see Cirque du Soleil shows. It's a place to go take roller coaster rides. Like, it was a place where people got run out to the desert and shot in a hole. You know, it's way different. Yeah.
Luckily, we just escaped that. We didn't get too deep into gambling.
Yeah. So, do you ever think about coming to Canada playing shows?
We do, actually, and we have been planning on, actually. So our next tour is going to be around February of next year of 2018, because right now we're kind of working on a new material.
Mm-hmm. Cutting out.
So we do want quite a few times, more than any other route, but we then want to wrap through Canada. It would probably start up in Vancouver and go from there.
Yeah, stay in Vancouver, though, because in February, if you're driving into the prairies of Canada, you probably put your life in danger, because it's pretty cold and snowy and not fun. The people are nice, but that's all. That's all you got. Yeah. Driving from the mountains from Vancouver.
That's probably good advice.
Yeah. Driving into Calgary, it's like a 12-hour drive when the roads are okay. But when the roads are bad, you could, I don't know. There's several TV shows about how tow trucks pull things out of woods because they crashed these reality shows. I don't know if you've seen any of them, but they're pretty sketchy.
There's been too many bands that have gone through that, right?
Yeah.
So if we don't hit the East Coast, or if we don't get too far into Canada from there, we are planning an East Coast tour where we're going to actually fly out to New York and kind of start there and then work our way down the East Coast. So maybe we'll do some Canada dates there as well.
Yeah. The tricky thing is that getting into Canada costs a lot of, I don't know what it, I know getting into America for Canadians, for especially if you're in a band, costs a lot of money, and we don't blame anybody for not coming here because it costs a lot of money, like work visas and, you know, you're going to come up here and marry all our women and take all our cigarettes. Yeah, you know, right?
You got us.
I know.
Our plan is foiled.
I know. Maybe it's back to Prohibition days, back in the days when we could drink and you guys couldn't. You come up and you take all our gasoline.
Get married for your health care.
Yeah. It's actually pretty ridiculous because, you know, this conversation come up a lot in the show. If you go to Europe and go to Germany, you just come with a guitar in your hand. They're like, hey, what are you doing here? We're like, here to play music. Great. Come on in. We love it. You know, and it should be that. I mean, we have a whole agreement with America. I mean, it's all there. Like the NAFTA agreement. It should just mean musicians can share, you know, something about culture. I don't know. Canada's really worried about losing its identity, I guess, when it comes to music.
Fair. You know, Mexico used to be the same way. We used to play down in Mexico quite a bit, and it's definitely not as easy now. Or it's equally as easy to get into Mexico, but not as easy to get back, even when you're American.
No, I get it.
and you're coming with a trailer full of gear and everything else.
No, I understand. I understand. It's the, when you do go to another country, though, you will be appreciated more. I do. I truly believe that. Because
it feels that way just traveling, and I travel quite a bit for work as well. And I've noticed that just any country you go to, it just feels like everybody's so hospitable compared to if you're in your home city.
Yeah, I mean, the further you go away, the more people are, whoa, you came from there? That's cool, you know. Like, and as we become more of a globalized community, it's like you got to fly to another continent now to get really appreciated as a musician.
Yeah, it's probably true.
Yeah. So you're going to, please come to Canada because we like aggressive music up here. We do.
I would absolutely love to. And I'm very excited, even if we just get up through Vancouver, just to start with that. Cause like I said, we haven't done, in the 6 years we've been a band, we haven't been up to Canada yet.
Yeah. do you have releases up here, or is this or how do you release? Do you self-release right now?
So yeah, the first album was done through Victory Records, so Sony Red Distribution.
Yeah,
and it was worldwide. Everything since then, we released through CD Baby, so it's all basically self-release, but they do all the distribution. So it's primarily online, so all the, you know, iTunes, Amazon, Spotify, but also they get in select stores depending on where the markets are and where we want to ship to. You know, we don't want to send, you know, 100 CDs to a store that's just going to hold on to them for forever, you know?
Yeah, distribution, I don't understand distribution anymore. I mean, to be able to self-release something seems to be a lot easier to do now than it was even 15 years ago. But the independent record labels, even 20 years ago, had the same kind of agreements when you made a record deal. But if you're in charge of your own thing, how, like CD Baby, I mean, great service, horrible name. CD Baby.
Yeah, no, CD Baby's great to us. So they, the distribution's super cheap. It's $49, gets you on any basically streaming outlet. You send them how many of our CDs you want them to try to get in store. So they'll get them in Walmarts and Targets and things like that. If your CD's well received, you know,
yeah,
they're not doing it for everybody. It just really depends on what type of press and what type of pool you have. They have on demand. If you need to call them and ask them a question, you get to them right away. They respond to their emails right away. And they're huge. I mean, they're distributing thousands of releases a year. Mm-hmm. And they still have this personal touch, you know. I think it's based right out of Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome, because it does, they sort of filled a hole that a lot of, you know, it's cream rises to the top industry too. So if you, like, it's kind of what you said, is like, if you have pull, they'll kind of, people will sort of go out of their way to help you out. But, you know, the idea that you can put anything out anywhere at any time, That's a sign of the times. So it's what's happening right now. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah. You know, before, I think, because we have tried other services, and a lot of services are much like CD Baby, but they take a monthly fee or an annual fee or a percentage of your sales. CD Baby doesn't do any of that. There's just one time fee and you're done.
Yeah. Do they do download codes and stuff?
Yep, they do.
Yeah. Because that's kind of the way to do it now. I think when you do you release vinyl?
We actually have, yes. So for our last release, we did a 7-inch for the EP. For Anti-Melody, we haven't done vinyl yet. We really want to. It's just vinyl is so expensive. So for this one, just how much money we had tied into it, we just couldn't make it happen at the beginning of the release. But I think it's going to come. You know, we actually even did cassettes for the last one, which is more of a novelty. It was the item where people walk by the merch booth and they're like, "Ah, that's funny. They have cassettes."
Yeah,
I have nowhere to play a cassette.
Somebody gave me a CD today, and I'm like, the only place I can play this is my car.
Yeah. You know, I buy CDs occasionally, but more just to support the band, and I'll just throw the band on Spotify and listen to it there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a big, well, streaming services are very good if you're a record label, I think. I mean, what's your true thoughts on like Spotify and Apple Music and things like that?
Yeah. You know, with the Spotify, they'll send us a check for $60 to $80 a month if we're lucky off of, you know, a couple hundred thousand plays. So it's definitely not enough to survive. It wasn't even enough to buy that steak dinner I had in Vegas the other night.
And that's the problem. I mean, that is the problem. If you're getting over 100,000 plays, that means people are listening to it. But people are getting a good service. I guess that's what it, I mean, that's what matters, is that people get to listen to it. And there's a venue and an avenue for them to actually get the music. The only trouble is that the bands kind of don't get the amount out of it. So if I could say for you, it's probably better that you go right to the band and go buy the merch from the band as opposed to, you know, stream it on Spotify.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So when let's hear a song.
You're right.
Speaking of which, I'm going to play a song. Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Cancer Eater. I hope this plays. Hold on.
Let me out of every line. I'll make out. end where I began. We won't ever be again.
Episodes, and man, you've got some huge people on there. I mean, Goldfinger, Propagandhi, did Kevin Lyman on there. I listened to that. I think that was actually the first one that I heard.
I met Kevin, and I've met all these people in my whole like life of doing this, and it's interesting that I can actually just, they don't know, some of them don't know me. Like Kevin Lyman didn't know me, but I used to work for Sum 41, and they'd do the Warped Tour, and I'd be the tour manager on it, and so I would bounce off of him, hey, how you doing, and He's a solid dude. He got a lot of heat actually from his from Warped Tour. I don't know if you saw some of like the things with like all
that. Especially his last few years, yeah.
Yeah, he got some heat. I mean, there's some funny false articles out there, like false statements saying that that they had to make the barrier like 100 feet away from the stage because of all the
I heard about
underage
that.
Sex predators and stuff that were in the band. So.
Yeah. I love that. The Hard Times articles, yeah, they blast him in the Warped Tour pretty hard.
Oh, my God, do they ever. And, you know, he's
They're
just...
funny, though.
Yeah, I mean, he grew up in punk rock, too. I mean, he's definitely a... Yeah. Yeah, but what we were talking about was real music played by real people. And, you know, the triggering part, I understand, like, it's... I don't... It sounds like this is pretty much played by, you know, good players, so...
I appreciate
that. And if it is triggered, then that's the best. It's even better.
we try to keep everything all real. All the instruments are all real. We're not auto-tuning the, you know, vocals. And we don't, you know, we do have, that song's not a great example, but we do have singing in some of the songs. But we're not auto-tuning the vocals, and we're not, you know, we're not punching in all the drums and kind of using Axe FX and everything. Not anything against bands that do that, especially because there's a lot of bands, if not, the majority of bands in our genre now are doing that and using a lot of backing tracks.
Yeah.
But it's just not for us. We think that, at least my philosophy is like, art is kind of supposed to be a reflection of humanity, and humanity's imperfect. So for me, like if we are a little bit off on something, that rawness gives it more of that honesty.
Yeah, honesty is the key word, because I have a pretty good bullshit meter. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't matter what type of music it is, you know, and I work with a lot of different types of music, and if I like the people, then I like the band better. That might not necessarily be a true, I guess, example of you know, appreciating music, but if someone really means what they say, then and they truly are standing behind it, the words to me aren't really that important, because it's the emotion that pushes through.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I know. I think some of the best artists aren't the most talented artists by any means. It's all about, you know, writing a good song and having the emotion behind it. And you, like you said, you can tell if someone's faking it, if they're just doing it to get plays or get, you know, someone to buy their album.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole market when people are now in charge of their own marketing, you can kind of take that a little bit too far with bands and image, and it's always been around. I mean, there's always been like. you know, we've had, you know, in my era, there's been bands like Saves the Day, and you're like, you guys are a good band, but you don't like anything but your band, you know? And I always had a problem with the judgy part of it, you know, like, we're on an independent record label, and, you know, but meanwhile, they're on tour with two bands that are on major record labels, so... You know what I mean? Like, so you can kind of be judgy and everything and be true to your thing, but that's also coming out of a young 20-year-old's mouth, you know? So I'm sure now he's probably pushing 35, 40. I think his attitude or their attitudes are changing with the times because they can assess things. It goes back to what we were talking about the early days, just a part of this. It's just like your brain can think better, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, everybody's going to have a different mindset, just like you'll have a different mindset, and I'll have a different mindset 10 years from now as well, you know?
Yeah, yeah, mine will be like, I was mixing a band at this theater I work at, and my comment was, I was mixing it so loud I was irritating myself. Just irritating me.
I don't know how you do that, man. Just the job of producing and mixing an album, I see why people have that passion. But I get tired of listening to my own music that many times when we're in the studio. I can't imagine if you actually have to sit behind the board and mix it yourself.
Yeah, that is, I mean, you're right. You're right. But, and also is after all the years, you kind of realize like, oh, it's tough to not fall into a rut and go like, oh, these are the things that work for me. So that the exciting part now for me is making it interesting for myself, but not reinventing it. That's that fine line, because a lot of people take a mix and throw it on its ear and go, I'm going to try something completely different, something I've never done before, and it never works, usually. It might work, like maybe...
Unless it's like Pet Sounds or Sgt. Pepper's, right?
Absolutely. Like, those are two classic examples of, like, how much pot can we smoke to make this thing sound awesome? And how is everybody going to relate to this, you know? Yeah, Pet Sounds was like, it was almost the death of Brian Wilson, right? Like, wow. So are you a Beach Boys fan? Because that Pet Sounds record is one of my favorite records of all time.
Yeah, no, it's one of the top ones up there. I can't say that if you just start digging into the deep cuts, I might not be the biggest on it, but I do think it's, you know, it's definitely up there.
Yeah, I mean, I like that because it doesn't necessarily, it says a lot to me, you know, because it's not just heavy music that turns you crank, you know, and I think perspective is a huge thing with music, that you got to have a little bit of everything and kind of find the good stuff in it all.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite artists of all time is actually Tom Waits.
Yeah, me too.
And for his lyrics, I mean, his lyrics and his personalities, like he created unique characters for his songs, and then he just lived those characters.
Yeah.
And I think like the age of, I don't want to say the age of the rock star, but the age of that persona is kind of seems like it's dying off, and it's weird because you'd think with the internet it would only get bigger.
Yeah. But,
well, I can't name a lot of people that are really building their own personas and known for that outside of the pop stars, the Lady Gaga and the, yeah.
Yeah, I think with YouTube, like music aside, there's a lot of YouTube personalities that people really, really, it's the same idea as what you're saying. They're making a persona, it's their identity, but it's not necessarily who they are. I mean, like I'm going to have a guy on the show.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, who is a big YouTube guy. And I'm not going to say because I don't know if he's coming on yet, but he, you know, if it's one of these people that has this whole life from YouTube and it's got nothing to do with music, but it's at the same time, it's how do you build that, you know? And a lot of it's just like music. It's all a bit of luck and it's a bit of putting your eggs in the right basket and then letting it go and seeing if something works. And 9 times out of 10, honesty wins, in especially when it comes to independent music.
Yeah, you know, when it comes to independent music, and I think that YouTube example is a great example. The thing that I find with independent music is I don't feel a lot of artists are really telling their story, and I don't mean telling their story in a way of marketing it, but they're just there's a lot of bands that I listen to it and I say this sounds good, but I don't know what they're about. I don't know who they are. When I look at it, it just confuses me, you know, like what they're singing about might not match up to what they look like, what their website looks like, what the kind of bands they're touring with. It just doesn't feel coherent, you know?
Yeah. So
even though it might sound good on the surface, it doesn't stick with me as much as someone else that's really done a good job at telling what they're about, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of where the podcast comes in. I mean, because it's people talking. And that's sort of like such a rare thing now, especially when this life is so, everything's so fast. It's like, and a bunch of noise out there, and people tune into the show because they want to hear a perspective, or someone's idea or ideals and their ethics, and that's got nothing to do with music, really. When you think about it, it's like, but it does, but it doesn't, because who you are as a person is you're representing your music, your band, and your, and I hate to say it, but your brand, you know, who you are in the whole encompassing thing. And it when you start a conversation, it's nothing but good. It's nothing but good, because it's like, oh, this person's a real person. This is cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
There's plenty of people that I was never a huge fan of. I knew of them, but I wasn't a huge fan until I actually heard them talk on a YouTube interview or on a podcast. I mean, we're driving so much that I listen to more podcasts than I probably listen to music.
Yeah.
And then there's certain podcasters that I listen to that I first get into it because they had a certain guest on there. Then I like their style. And even on the guests that I don't really know very much, or maybe I'm not a huge fan of, mm-hmm. I listen to it just because I like the style. And then I become a fan of that person because I realize that they have a personality and they have things to say that resonate.
Yeah. My big turnaround, because like I always, like I'm grew up in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and I love Van Halen. But when Sammy Hagar joined Van Halen, I was like, that's it. I'm done. You know, but then I heard him in an interview on Adam Carolla's podcast, and I'm like,
I think a lot of people did that.
I'm like, holy, this guy's awesome. You know, like this guy's cool. And he's just a normal dude, you know, because, you know, he's Sammy Hagar. He's got a name, Hagar. He's got a song called I Can't Drive 55. Like, nobody can anymore in America, right? Because the speed limit's just faster.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, no, you're right. I think a lot of times too that they're the victim of, they did have a persona back then and they're playing into the persona, and it was one that you probably didn't like.
Yeah.
So when you actually listen to them be a real person, you're like, okay, I get it now.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to Lady Gaga, I am not ever a Lady Gaga fan, and she kind of annoyed me at times, but then I recently she has that Netflix documentary on. I said, okay, I'm going to watch this. And I'm like, she is so talented. She's getting on the, you know, the piano and playing piano, playing strings. She just seems like a normal person and has like, you know, just, I think everything that I saw from them, I'm like, wow, now I actually go back and I listen to it. I'm like, okay, I respect this and appreciate it for what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, they premiered that in Toronto at TIFF, Toronto International Film Festival. And I had a job to work at a theater to put three PA companies together because Gaga wanted to play at her own release of her documentary. And so because it was all late, there wasn't one PA company that could bring everything in. So we had to outsource stuff from like New York and Toronto and different parts all over the place. But three of them all came together. I don't know if you know, but sound systems, if they don't all come from the same spot, necessarily don't fit together. So Gaga rolls in and she's playing a piano. Well, first of all, it was a band. Then it went down to a three-piece. Then it was, by the end, it was just her and a piano. And it was 25 hours of work for me, like in 2 days, so Gaga could play one song. It was brutal. It was the worst.
Did that make you lose respect or gain respect?
It freaked me out because anything I do now, like that seems like off the hook. Like we have John Tesh, who's like a middle of the road piano player guy. He's coming to our theater next week, and they have these weird, outrageous demands. I'm like, that's nothing compared to Lady Gaga, who they want like specific microphones and pianos and wave servers and all these things, and for and a monitor desk and a front of house desk for piano and voice. Like the guy was literally using three channels on this 48 channel mixing desk. It's brutal.
Now you have the confidence to know you can accomplish anything.
That's right. The bar is very high now when I can make Gaga happy.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just assumed she was a product of, you know, some producers getting her in a studio and telling her what to do and, you know, making her, building up her image and putting, you know, producing all the music themselves. But it really seems like she has a pretty heavy hand in what she does.
Yeah, no, she's wildly talented. And I like the fact in the documentary where she's talking shit about Madonna. I thought that was pretty funny.
I did like that. I screenshot, I don't know if there's a band called Norma Jean, which Madonna's, real name.
Yeah.
And she says something to the extent of the original Norma Jean or something. She like makes a reference to knowing there's two different Norma Jean artists. I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, enough about this Gaga stuff.
This is the Gaga podcast.
It's the Gaga podcast. I'm Simon. That's Brandon. Radio We're talking about Gaga. So, okay, so new album's out. And you're putting it out, and you're making possibly vinyl, and yep.
CDs are out. Yep, we've got CDs out. Do have them in select stores, and it's on any streaming website. Anything you go to online / American Standards, I can almost guarantee you're going to find this.
Yeah, actually, if you just type in Google American Standards, you either get the toilets, because they're American Standards, and it's or the band. You're actually third on the Google list. That's it.
They've been around for about 200 years.
Here you go.
And we're already, in certain times, we've been kind of back and forth on that number one spot on Google. So we're going to get them sooner or later. And then we're going to get so big that they're going to sue us. That whole adding the S isn't gonna work anymore.
Oh, yeah. That must be frightening. Cease and desist stuff.
Well, we did trademark it when we first put it out, but we had to add the S on there.
Really? That's all you need is an S?
Apparently. I mean, it worked at the time, and when we were under the label, that's kind of what we had to go through to do it.
Yeah, yeah. How was Victory? Be honest. How was working with Victory?
You know, I think, we were on an imprint of Victory. We were on something called We Are Triumphant. So Victory did all the distribution and everything. So we didn't have any direct relationship with Tony or anything. They had us on their website. They'd post about us occasionally. And it helped us up front. I think it gave us that name association. This is 2010, 2011,
yeah.
Gave us some name association and credibility. So when we're out there touring, maybe people are willing to take a chance on us.
Yeah.
But then obviously, you know, the name started getting kind of a different connotation to it, where then the opposite started happening, where people are saying, well, I don't really want to work with anybody that's related to Victory.
Yeah.
Even though we were going through a kind of a subset of it. So there was that piece. There's also a piece that the label particularly that we are on, We Are Triumphant. They're kind of trying to find a way to make up for lost CD sales. You know, albums weren't drawing money. So instead of banking on the quality of their artists and getting five or 10 artists and really developing them, they're just saying, let's get 50 or 60 artists on the roster and hope that one of them takes off. And anybody else that doesn't take off right away in the first few months, we're not going to give any development to them. So we weren't getting tour support. We were booking all our own tours. We're being asked to put out videos and go to the studio and find it for ourselves and fund it ourselves and then still give them that same percentage. So at the end of the day, we figured we're putting in all the work. We might as well get the credit for it. So we know any work that we put into it is, or anything that comes from it, is a direct result of the work that we put into it.
Yeah, that was the same ethic that it was 10 years before that. And in the early 2000s, I had a band. We put some records out under Bad Taste Records in Sweden, which was like Danko Jones, Last Days of April. Who else was on that label? Yeah. So it was like, it was a thing, but at the same time, same thing. Like, we still had to pay for all our own plane flights. Like, we had to pay for our own recording. Although I had my own recording studio, that was helpful. And we used any money they gave us to buy recording gear. But the second record we put out with them was like that they didn't want anything to do with us. And we put this great record out. Well, in my opinion, it was pretty good. But they just didn't want it. And it was like, okay, because they kept putting other stuff out. And that was sort of the dawn of the death of independent music in the early 2000s. Yeah. Like, the industry just took a big old dump and said, because of that reason that everything was just so bloated and fat, they couldn't, you know, it was this model that just didn't ever work. And it still didn't work. Sounds like Victory tried it on for like 10 more years, Dennis from 10 Foot Pole, he was like, I think Tony was threatening to kill him or something. Like, it was bad. Like, it was really bad. Like, you know, but
yeah, you know, I think they realized that's why you see these 360 deals now, where they're like, all right, we're going to take a piece of the merch and take a piece of this and try to recoup it somehow. Because really, as a band, I mean, that's why I think you see a lot of these old guys getting back on the road there from bands that haven't been active for 10 or 20 years or more.
Yeah,
because they either didn't invest well and they need to get back out there and sell some merch and make some money off shows.
Yeah, the 360 deal, it's just confuses me. Like, I really don't understand how you make the t-shirts or it's your band, they put the records out, but how can they come and grab your merch? I just don't. How does that work? Like, how would that even work? I guess if you're Justin Bieber and you do a 360 deal, I guess that's good because you can put your own perfume or something out, you know, but if you're just a band that puts out punk rock records, like, how does it, you know, that's how you live. That's how bands live, is selling merch.
That, exactly. If we can't make money off merch, we can't tour, you know.
Yeah.
We actually had a we had a label. I haven't told anybody outside the band about this, but we had a label that approached us a few weeks ago, and a huge label. I mean, I'm talking a label that had artists that were selling 200 to 500,000 albums and within the last 10 to 15 years, and which is kind of not a labels. A lot of bands aren't selling that kind of quantity of CDs anymore. And they reached out to us to do a deal. And I don't want to say the label name or anything, but their deal was essentially they wanted to take, it was 85% off the top, which isn't horrible, you know, for some labels, but they also wanted us to pay for our recordings, give them 4 exclusive designs that we had to, you know, fund the design, the making design, giving it to them. And then we'd get $1 off the top of any t-shirt sold on tour. So, I mean, think of how many t-shirts you have to sell making $1 to actually put money in the tank. You have to sell 100, 200 shirts a night just to get to the next show.
No thanks.
So yeah, we said, you know, you guys had some really respected bands that we looked up to, but we know at our size, we're not going to be able to, you know, continue playing music with that type of
Yeah.
deal.
Yeah, there was you heard of the Weaker Dance? The Weaker
Yeah,
Dance? They got offered a big record deal, like sort of in their second record, and they're like, it has to be $1.6 million. And where they came up with that money, I don't know, but that was their dollar amount. For us to sign a record deal, it needs to be $1.6 million, and nobody obviously could come up, you know, with a any sort of, so it kind of, they priced themselves out of that major record deal market. So they came and they said, this is the way it's going to be, and they did much better. I mean, as a band, you know, I was very close to that band because the drummer, I used to play in a band with a drummer in the 90s.
Oh,
Yeah, so I know those. I used to live with the bass player John Sutton. He was a roommate of mine in Winnipeg when I lived out there. So, but they kind of just said, we're going to do it. We're going to do it our way. We don't want anybody telling us what to do. And then they ended up like touring in a van for like 10 years, and then they finally just said, oh, you know what, we'll take a tour bus now. Like, it was finally like, we've paid our dues, you know. And
yeah.
there's such a thing, you know, where bands that get signed to a record label and they just jump in a tour bus and drive across America and thinking that that's what bands do, and that's not what bands do.
Not at all. You know, I've seen some huge bands that maybe used to do that 10 or 15 years ago that are now renting trailers. You know, they come up to the venue in a U-Haul
Yeah.
or a rented van just to save money.
Yeah. Yeah, that is in it really does appreciate. Like, I did one tour bus tour in Europe playing in a band, and it was like so expensive. And any money we made went straight to that tour bus, but it was pretty sweet. It
Yeah,
was
it's an
pretty,
experience.
it
I
definitely
mean, going right
was.
back to it's like it depends on what you look at music as. If you're looking at it to make money, then don't buy the tour bus.
No.
But you know, there's so many experiences that I've had through music that yeah, maybe if we ever get to the point where we can afford the tour bus for a week, we might just do it to try
Yeah.
it.
Yeah, it is one of those things where you hate its gluttonous, like, but if you're in a band that travels whatever for 2 months and every day you're playing a show, by the like we were just talking about this, about like after a couple of weeks you start getting tired. But I'm pretty convinced if you had someone driving you around and you didn't have to pay for hotels, or when you fall asleep you wake up next place, there is a benefit part of there is a benefit to that. But you have to have that dollars and cents figure behind your show pay to actually warrant it. You know, you can't take record label advance money and expect to you know, it's a big chance. I worked for Sum 41 for the first year of their major record label stuff, and we toured in a van like for a year and a half. And it was a specific, there was two reasons why they did it. Number one, it saved money, and number two, other bands looked at them differently. Like, if they
Oh,
rolled up in a tour bus, people would be like, well, look at these fucking rock stars with their big old tour bus. And it was a crew of one, and that was me, you know. So we're doing Warped Tour and I'm driving them all over America. They're like 18 and 19 years old, and it's
yeah.
me, and I'm in my mid 20s, I guess, or late 20s, and here I am driving around, you know. So it was weird. But when they finally sold records, that's when they got the tour bus, and they never looked back, you know. And that's important. There's like so many reasons why that's such a good idea for bands, is to sort of live in a van, you know. It will appreciate, and if whatever, when the big bus comes, it's worth it at that point, you know.
No, I agree. I mean, the tour bus is back to the $100 steak, right? It's gluttonous, but maybe you just want to try it.
Yeah.
I think the opposite side of that, the van is almost the same respect that you gain from being a touring band that actually goes out there and watches the locals that are playing the show, right? Yeah. As opposed to sits in the back and kind of drinks in the green room. And that's something we try to do every time too. We try to get out there and hang out at the merch booth and talk to people and, you know, hang out with the bands that are wanting to hang out, the local bands, and watching their sets, you know.
It's very important.
And I think that builds a different respect for your band and you as a musician. And the next time you come through the city, even if that band's not playing the show, they're probably going to tell their friends and tell their fans that are going to come out and have a beer with you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where we're at. I mean, like the whole thing of like, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, like I don't talk to people, but he's a cool dude, you know, meet him, he's nice. But, you know, like, but you meet rock stars and you're like, yeah, I'm kind of over rock stars. Like, there's not too many people that really phase me and throw me. I bet if I met Bruce Springsteen, I'd be a little, whoa, look at you. You're Bruce Springsteen.
Meet the boss.
Yeah, the meet the boss. He's called the boss. Like, come on. but yeah. There's not a lot of people that I get to meet where it's like, yeah, you know, like, whoa, I can't talk to you because you're, you know, they're all people. You
starstruck.
Know? Yeah, starstruck. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so... Yeah, when you go out and the Mighty Body Boston's Dickie, you'd always sit in the merch table, and you know what? Help with merch sales because people were like, "Hey, you're Dickie from the Mighty Mighty Boston's," and Spike from Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. He has that ukulele band. Guess who's selling the merch? Him.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he's
That's
selling awesome. It. You know why? Because people want to talk to him. That's cool.
Yeah, you know something I read once in I think a music blog or something. They said one of the best things you could do as a frontman is the second your set is over, don't walk into the back and, you know, don't go into the green room and all that. Just walk straight through the crowd. Go right off front of the stage, walk straight through the crowd, and then walk right back to the merch booth.
Yeah.
Because then people know where your merch booth is. They're willing to talk to you. And like you said, you could kind of build those relationships. And it feels more personal, you know? It feels like when you're someone's friend or when you got out of that bond, then you want to support them more, even if they weren't the greatest band in the world. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And when you're playing with local bands and things like that, you meet some great people. But it also, if you meet people who aren't so great, it kind of puts them in there, gives them, like, you're almost taking them to school about how bands should act around each other. Because I've met bands and they're like rock stars. And you're like, what? Who are you? Like, you play in this little town, you know, and I'll be in some weird little town and I'm play with this band. It's like, really? That's all you got, you know what I mean? But it's like, then they're rock stars to boot. So I guess you're doing them a service by saying, no, this is how bands act. Bands act this way. They don't act like assholes. They act like normal people who like to meet other people. And the reason they're here is to high-five the people that like their music. Plain and simple, right?
Yeah, it's the fake until you make it mentality that they take the wrong way, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well... You know, I wish you all the luck, man, because, you know, touring in a band, I was thinking about this today, touring in a band today, it is such a tricky endeavor. And you guys, you know, you've managed to do something that a lot of bands don't get to do, and you have, like, people who like your band. And that's, it's such a tough industry now, you know, and, you know, good for you. You know, that's amazing that you've actually... You've made something out of nothing. And that's important stuff to remember about music because it's made from nothing. Like, really, it comes out of your brain. You put it onto something and people listen to it and like it. That's like, you would be burnt at the stake like 400, 500 years ago. They'd be like, what is this heretic? How is he making my mind all like, you know? So, you know, it needs to be noted, you know, that bands that go out and do it and try it and succeed. And it's not all succeeds. It's not all wins. It's sometimes the losses is what makes a band stronger, you know? And you guys, you know, good music.
And I think when you go into it with the right mindset, right? You go into it with the mindset of winning isn't signing to the biggest label and making the most money in the world. Winning is just being able to go out there and have these experiences. And anything else that comes your way, I mean, we're always surprised by getting show offers and getting tour offers and whatever it is. Every time that comes along, that's just like an added cherry on top, you know?
Yeah.
All we expect is to have a place to plug in. It doesn't matter if it's a venue or some, you know, abandoned warehouse.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing, man. Well, it was good to talk to you. I'll get all your, because you got a lot of Twitter socially kind of stuff happening. I want to put all that on the page. So it was good to talk to you, man.
You too, Simon. Thanks, man.
And that was Brandon Kellum from the American Standards, the band downstate, way down there in Phoenix, bragging about the temperature. It's really cold up here right now. Christmas is just around the corner, and this is year 3 of podcasting. I think officially, as of this episode, it is officially three years in podcasting. And what's going to be coming up is a best of episode. I'm not sure when I'm going to release it. I got it all ready to go. I got to find me a co-host. Here's the thing. How about this? Now you're listening to this. Anybody want to be a co-host on the best of? I will be taking submissions. Go over Facebook. Go to facebook.com/apologpod or get in contact with me by going apologpod.ca/contact. And if you want to be a co-host on the show, what you will get, a free t-shirt. You will get my Foursquare Band discography for free, and I'll send you some beer. So how about that? That's pretty good. That's pretty good incentive to become a co-host on the Apologue Podcast. I'm going to post that on Facebook, too. So everybody, this is probably going to happen in a couple weeks, but I am going to start recording it and get it all together and get in touch with me. That'll be fun. That will be fun to do. I'll take anybody, really, because I did it by myself last year, and it was kind of fun, but at the same time, I really need people to talk to. That's what makes this show tick. So everybody, next week, who I got? I got Dejan Martineau, who is a producer, engineer, songwriter. He is a super swell dude. It's a long one, too. Goes almost over an hour and a half. So get comfy, get your slippers on, and see you next week, everybody. Thanks again for listening to the show. Have a great week, and...